This episode is sponsored by HelloFresh, America's number one meal kit. You're listening to Nakedly Examined Music, a podcast about songs and songwriters. My name is Mark Lintonmeyer. My guest for episode 195 is Nicholas Tremulous. He's released 10 solo albums plus a few collaborations since 1982. You're right now hearing Heartbeat Getting Stronger from his self-titled debut album from 1985. We're going to be talking about his most recent album, Rarified World, from 2021 by Nicholas Tremulous and the Prodigals. The song is Amanda and the God's Honest Truth. Then we'll look back to his 2008 album, Little Big Songs, for the song called Buffalo Man. Then all the way back to his 1986 album, More Than Truth. The song is called River of Love. We'll conclude by listening to a 2010 single, Superhuman Love, by the Nicholas Tremulous Orchestra. It also showed up on a 2013 album, For the Baby Doll. For more information, you can look up Nicholas on SoundCloud or Facebook. For more about this podcast, see nakedlyexaminedmusic.com. Make sure you're subscribed directly to the Nakedly Examined Music podcast feed. And while you're subscribing to that, please leave a nice rating and review. Finally, if you want to support my efforts, you can go to patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic and sign up for my ad-free feed, which also gets you my detailed song breakdown episode notes. So I will play a little bit of something I remembered from my youth that has a style that we're not otherwise going to talk about. Heartbeat Getting Stronger from your first album, 1985.
Insane.
I was playing for somebody else a clip of one of those first two albums and then some of your more recent stuff and just could not believe that it was the same person. Was it just the major label influence? Because the 1982 single you shared with me does not have that super 80s thing going.
No, that single is a reflection of what I wanted life to be.
Okay.
This amalgam of music that no A chord is better than another A chord, you know, like my A chord's better than yours. But it was just that I was kind of into what was called at the time punk jazz, if that makes any sense. Coming out of bands like Defunct and Ronald Shannon Jackson Decoding Society and James Chance and people like that, it just made sense to me, given the fact that I grew up in a jazz household but played rock music, that it could all be mixed together.
So the jump between that and then your first full album is not because of label influence or because it was the 80s or something. That's just the sound that you had and you had more money for the first album. Is that?
I think it did influence that because it was a very hard style of music because I wanted success. And when you're young, whether you know you're being swayed or not, you're getting pulled towards success. And there was a huge market of 12-inch records coming out that were great. The early dance music that was coming out of New York City and stuff like that. And I was very enthralled by it and stuff. So I started making more R&B-oriented songs, is the best way to put it. I think wanting to be successful was really important to me when I was young and wanting to be on a major label. Because there was no indie scene at the time, really. Mm-hmm. So you kind of wind up getting swayed whether you know you are or not. I certainly thought that the people that the gatekeepers knew more about the music biz than I did. And I wanted to be in the music business. So yeah, I was swayed, not as a decision, but it just happens sometimes, you know.
I'm very familiar with the choose among your many influences for the thing that you think that audience, that time period needs. It's not a matter of I'm selling out, I'm doing something fundamentally inauthentic. It's just narrow the focus.
I was certainly trying to get swayed. We were slowly but surely becoming a really popular band in Chicago at the time.
When did that start? So I saw you'd been playing for like a decade before this first album?
Yeah, well, I started when I was 13 years old and I started playing in bands more or less professionally when I was 14 years old. So hitting the road, jumping into vans, doing all that sort of stuff. In the beginning, I think nobody really wants to lead a band when I was a kid. So whoever sang was the guy that had the most chutzpah, is the best way to put it. And I didn't want to be a singer at the time. I wanted to be a lead guitar player because all my heroes were lead guitar players. I think that desire was that until I started. I just couldn't stand being in bands where people sang like shit so often. And I knew I could sing better than them. So that's what started me singing. And then songwriting was around 17 or 18, I started writing songs. At that time, I was trying to sound like Cheap Trick. I saw him when I was 15 years old in a bar with my fake IDs and went, this is amazing. Just, you wanted to be part of that scene, you know, and the sort of glamorous allure of what being a rock musician was, I think. Having sex with lots of women, all those little trappings that somebody who's going through puberty is very attracted to. Mm-hmm. And then as I get older, I want it to be more artistic. That's all. Once the libido calms down a little bit.
Let's jump to the new stuff and then we'll work our way slowly backward a little bit. So the song that I picked off, you said your most recent thing is this album by Nicholas Tremulous and the Prodigals, Rarefied World, 2021. I saw there was another one, For Homer, the piano solos. Is that actually older, but then you just put it on the streaming services?
It's older and I just put it out digitally because it just was sitting there. I went through a really tough period right before I made the Rarefied World album. I made that record during the pandemic and I got really sick. And 6 weeks of sick, 5 weeks of sick, you know, 104 degree temperature. And in the last 2 weeks, my son died suddenly. The only way I could cope with myself a couple months after that was to go make this album that I'd been sort of working on the idea of for a long time. And it took a bigger sense of pathos when it came out because I basically had the worst experience of my life happen. And it was sort of my way of digging my way back to sanity, was to get together with a bunch of 17 musicians or so and do my arrangements. And so this record came out. Most of it was written before that had happened, but it's smeared all over the record in my performances because when I work with that producer, a guy named Rob Fraboni, he was very much into capturing a performance. So it's a very captured record, not a produced record, although it's heavily arranged because I'm an arranger as well.
Well, the song I picked off that, it's a very, very diverse record, was Amanda and the God's Honest Truth. I'll be upfront. It's because of the bridge. It takes so many twists and turns. It's very ranged in the bridge. Folks will hear that when it happens.
I'll tell you what that bridge is about. And it was always my idea. I write songs very visually. And that bridge was supposed to be this little modern ballet moment. And I mapped it all out, what I wanted the movements to be and the dance and everything else. And I guess I was just thinking again, like I did when I started, which was just, and then you can do this and you combine this with this and this. And so I have a whole mapped out storyline that goes through that. It's very filmed, but including when the song comes back in, the last overhead tracking shot, which looks like the taxi driver at the end when they show the murder scene and everything. So that was supposed to be a little ballet in the middle. I wasn't just trying to be an oddball.
Do you have any other words of sort of about the theme that would prepare people to hear it before we
hear it? You know, I had a friend that was a student and a songwriting pal who I teach at Columbia College. And she told me about a teacher that in her high school that made sexual advances to her. And she said, I wish I was as old as I am now so I could have beat that guy down, given him a beat down. And I thought, okay. And her name's Andy, but her real name's Amanda. So I just used her as the thing. I called her and I said, look, I'm writing a song. It's really not about you, but it's about a person that gets abused. Only she gets to shoot the abuser. And she went, oh, well, great. And that's why it says in the beginning of the song, this song's for Amanda, a.k.a. Andy. Her name's Andy Williams. She's a great songwriter. But she just thinks it's hilarious I wrote this thing. So, but yeah, it was just about all those people you see that get put in that position and how they're victimized and villainized at the same time, at least in the press and, you know, how we do it. Chicago's the perfect example of hearing about kids getting shot, for example, and then the smear campaign that goes on why they deserve to be shot.
This is the story of a man, a.k.a. Andy. I saw a man departing something made of steel. It looked vaguely like a weapon, some sinister possession you would read about in books by lonely men who acted out their vengeance with a pen. But not Amanda. See, she's a girl of action who gains her satisfaction without words or empty threats. No tears, no regrets. You could say this is a story of a hero. You could say it's just the folly of the damned. You could say it's just a lie or box office gold. But it's a God's honest truth. At least that's what I'm told. Down in Garfield Park, in a high rise after dark, you can feel his anger growing. The footsteps getting louder, like a beeping of a radar. And her eyes are shutting tighter. Is it fear inside the knowing that keeps the ill wind blowing? The roaring indecision, the beatings and the bruises, the weakness and the shame of it, the countless sad excuses. Was it Jesus or the devil's hand that kept her in the hide? Was it promises that night she found a fully loaded 45 on Independence Drive? You could say this is the story of a hero. You could say it's just the folly of the damned. You could say it's just a lie, a box office gold. But it's a God's honest truth. At least that's what I'm told.
All right, so this minor key, this vaguely Latin, what do you know what influence you're pulling on here specifically, stylistically?
Two things. I got called by one of my best friends on earth who was coming to do four shows in Chicago. His name's Alejandro Escovedo. And he said, why don't we do the first John Prine record, which I hadn't heard in a million years. And so we reinvented all his songs, but that started me unknowingly back into doing story songs again, because I really was kind of just trying to really simplify my lyricism. And at the time, I think stepping into John's world, and he was still alive and he said hi to us before we went on over the phone. It was really lovely. But stepping into his songs unknowingly brought me back into the story song world, which will do because if you live in John Prine tunes, man, it feels good. So I lived in that first album for about a month. We worked on it over the phone and then put this band together. And it felt so great to live inside his songs. And I think it changed the direction that I was looking to write in, you know, because you always just write and songs are startling. The less you know about them when they're done, they're almost better. They're such mysterious things. They just come out. But I can honestly say that was a big part of it. The Latin thing has always been my thing. Since the beginning, my dad, just who was an amateur musician, jazz player, loved Latin music so much. I mean, he took me to see Eddie Palmieri when I was 12 years old and said, this is it. This is the thing. And I've been following it ever since. I actually got kicked out of high school for faking an excuse to go play in Little Village in Chicago with this high school Latin band. Both schools found out, and that was the end of me. I forged the paperwork.
Okay.
I wanted to play with them so bad.
So how are you communicating with this drummer, for instance? And you got, what, two percussionists on top of the drums? Is it just that you're playing your riff and they just kind of can hear what you're doing? Or is there a more explicit vocabulary of, remember this song, remember, you know, here's a groove?
In this particular instance, because I'm working and I know I'm about to work with about minimum 15 musicians a song and stuff, I made very elaborate demos. I made that drum beat sort of thing. The percussion, at that point, when you come into the studio, you just let them go. I play with such great musicians that there was not one rehearsal. The whole album was finished in 10 days.
Even the extra percussion stuff, I don't remember the names of all the hand percussion that's like.
Bongos and timbales on there and shakers and all that. And, well, that's the one thing about Latin bands. If you've ever played in a Latin band, a lot of rock bands will have one guy come in and play congas or something, right?
Sure.
Once you've played with a percussion section in a Latin band, and in my case, two percussionists, it would be really hard to go back to one because there's something that really happens that the conversation between two percussionists and a drummer is absolutely amazing. And you want to stay out of the way and just go along for the ride. But I don't tell them how to play. They're all masters.
You got your groove percussion, but then you got your effect percussion that like actually takes up a lot of space. This, you know, so it's just one guy. I mean, I notice we don't have like whistle on this. You know, it's not that Latin.
No. But that's Jean-Christophe Leroy. He's a great timbale player and was recommended by Jose Rendon, my sort of percussion leader in that situation. And Larry Beers, my drummer, they all knew each other and they knew they would love to play together. And that's half of it. You just find guys that are still song players. And that's the key. They have to listen better than they play even. And that's really the mark of a great musician. And I'm lucky in that I have a band full of those guys.
Now, in terms of constructing the story here, I mean, there's sort of once you start on a story road, I mean, this could be an 8-minute song. It just depends on how much detail you put in. I noticed the chorus, you want it to be able to repeat at a number of points. So it's like, you say, this is the story of a hero, you know, so some sort of, we're backing off and giving some sort of summary commentary. So you can do that at multiple points, but normally a story is linear such that were there extra verses that got lopped off? Did you have to expand this? How did the story come together here?
What I tend to do is I don't write in one fell swoop. I had the idea, it's the God's honest truth, which I really like. But out on the veranda, I saw Amanda holding something made of steel. It looked vaguely like a weapon. That started it. That first verse was kind of beautiful to me. And that kept me going in the story. And then I'd been driving down Garfield Park a lot. And I know that at night it turns into a place that's kind of a shooting gallery. In the evening, you can hear the guns going off and all that. But otherwise, it's this beautiful park. It was just a matter of where I was driving at the time and wanting to write something about the triumph of someone that gets punished for it. It's really a triumph. I mean, Amanda gets to kill someone who's been killing her psychically and physically for years. And I love the idea of people getting their comeuppance. You know, I guess societally, we live in a place where people are afraid, especially females, to become victims in courtrooms and stuff like that, because they're often turned on their tail and they have to live through a very unpleasant experience again. Someone's going to turn you into someone that, you know, if you didn't want it, you wouldn't be in this neighborhood kind of vibe that comes off. So I wanted to write something about that phenomenon that I don't like, you know. It's a little bit of a, I think it's a very heroic tune. And that's what I like about it. At least the video, had I made it, and had I made that little thing, it would have looked like George Washington crossing the Delaware. Because I thought, I really liked her, you know, a lot.
Well, that's exactly what I was going to ask you. Thinking in filmic terms, how important would it be to actually try to film this? Or is it, no, this is, you know, like a novel, like any other, it paints the picture enough itself.
I think, in a sense, the song itself is probably more made for film than it's made for anything else. We play it live and we love doing it. But every time we do it, I see the movie that I wanted to make, you know? But I also know that my eyes are bigger than my stomach sometimes. And it would have been a very expensive video to incur because I would have had actors. I need stages, lots of lighting to make it work. A choreographer, a heroine that can dance and is also very expressive. I see it in my head all the time when I hear it, though, and when I'm playing it.
So where do you think this narrator character then comes from in terms of even the way you're singing it, which is quite different from the way that you sang in the 80s? You left me to my own devices to figure out lyrics for this. And I'll say that that first line that you thought was the, you know, the thing that sets a scene, I could not figure out what you were saying.
Out on the veranda. Yeah, I saw a man pointing something made of steel, you know.
Yeah. So where does this, do you have any idea of sort of how this is developed or what you're channeling or what your influence is in terms of, I mean, this sort of sounds like, you know, like Bob Dylan's The Hurricane, you know, we're going to tell a story.
I see what you're saying that way, but I'm thinking of all, you know, I went through my Harry Smith period where I was listening to all those. John Hardy was a desperate man, and I loved those songs.
Uh-huh.
As a kid, Oh Susanna, I loved that. The Sun's So Hot, I Froze to Death. So, I mean, it really comes from that, just adoring those kind of songs and Stagger Lee and Stacko Lee, you know, the variation of it. I think it was kind of that. I wanted to write the ballad of somebody. So it's really like, I mean, if this had come out in the 40s, it would be the ballad of Amanda, blah, 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 or something. And it would be ripped from the headlines. That's kind of how they wrote. I mean, they were very topical about what was going on, including Woody Guthrie and everything else.
Right. Very much out of the folk tradition. Are there other like folks writing in a Latin vein doing that? I mean, I know like Alejandro Escovedo's stage show, the crossing the border, whatever that's called. You know, one of his recent things is also theatrical in this way, although he has less overt Latin stuff in that, I think.
No, you know, he's kind of a punk rocker. I mean, that's really what he is. And he comes via Latin through Mexican music and border music because, you know, he's from that area. All those guys, the Towns Van Zants and everything, those guys were around when he was starting out. So he was hanging with the Guy Clarks and all that. But they certainly do, you know, Pancho and Lefty and all that stuff. I think that style comes to him. You know, it's funny because his uncles are all percussionists and they play basically Afro-Cuban music. My percussionist, Jose Rendon, is Mexican, but he's playing Afro-Cuban music, and it's really not the same. He's playing Puerto Rican Cuban music. He's not playing Mexican music. So I think that most of us kind of go there because we just, if you're a musician long enough, you realize that those Tito Puente records and everything are kind of the height of, I mean, you have these expansive chords and this polyrhythmic thing going down. And it's very exotic and sexy. And that's what really brought me there. Also, just because it's, besides jazz and a few pop songs, I mean, you could say that the Coasters have a lot of Latin music in it when you think of those tunes, because there's tons of Puerto Rican percussion in there. But I'm just trying to mix things up. I don't think I can write a new song. I don't think anybody can. It's how you mix it up. It's what stew you put it in the end, that makes it sound different. Why this album is different is because of its Latin influences and its soul influences mixed together. But certainly, if you think of Spill the Wine, I mean, they did it pretty good. Curtis Mayfield constantly did it. And he's a big influence on me. My cousin played with him. First rock star I ever.
So I know we spent a lot of time on the song already, but I promised we would talk about the bridge. Those chords are right out of, you know, Pat Metheny sort of jazz or whatever, those really thick chords answered by the horn things.
Yeah.
We're starting to go on a journey here. Any comments about that little chunk in particular?
Well, yeah. At that point, what happens is the camera pans up over her and she starts to spin as those chords start to spin around her. Then the next section, which goes boom, 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 is these dancers that come and find the gun on the street that she finds and they hand it to her. The second half of that, which is this sort of insane atonal thing, is her spinning with the guns in her hands.
Yes, then that's the classic spinning.
Then it goes bah, bah, and it's this walking up the stairs situation that happens later in that I saw her just walking up the stairs. Opens the door. When you hear the last ba-da-dap, ba-da-dap, ba-da-daps, that's three shots to the guy. And then when the song comes back in, ba-da-da-da-da, you have the tracking shot from Taxi Driver, which is that complete aerial shot that backs over the rooms with the cops looking at him in the chair right after he goes, you know, to his own head. And that's that. And then it backs up from that and goes into another stage set, which is the courtroom. And that's the final verdict for her and everything like that. The last chorus without drums has her standing majestically like Wonder Woman with wind blowing on her and a flag. And I never figured out what I wanted to be on the flag. But, you know, that's where you can say this is a story of a hero. And I wanted her to be heroic at the end of it. So that's what's going on in that baby. It's very visual.
And I assume that given that you're paying for studio time for 19 people that you did not rehearse with, you didn't go through that. Did you explain that all to them or that?
The song was complex enough to play that I just had to say 2-4 bar here, stuff like that, you know, rest for a second. And I send them the demo. I'd made a very precise demo of that because I knew I had to get them in and out of there pretty quick. I had 10 songs to get through with 6 horn players and 3 string players. You know what I mean? So it's a lot.
Let's stop for some sponsor talk. I have 2 quick stories for you. First, last Mother's Day, I wanted to make a home-cooked meal for my wife. I found a veggie paella recipe online. I went to the grocery store specifically to get ingredients for this. They didn't have quite everything. I had to substitute one kind of chili for another kind of chili, or there was a kind of paprika that I wasn't sure if what I was buying was actually what they were asking for. Anyway, I'm in the grocery store for really quite a long time for what's going to be one meal. I get the stuff home, and the recipe is a little ambiguous. I'm not sure if I'm following it quite right. I end up screwing up something about exactly what stage to cook the rice in. At what point I'm trying to follow the recipe on my phone and it says, hey, you've been looking at this too long, tries to put a paywall in front of me. So I have to go get it off my computer and print it out. Overall, it came out okay. And I have leftovers that I don't really want. Second story, I received a box from HelloFresh that includes 3 chef-selected recipes. I have chosen the veggie category. I have told them, don't give me something that's super mushroom-based, and they all look good. The ingredients are pre-portioned. The instructions are colorful and clear. And without fuss of any sort, I make the sweet potato and pepper quesadillas, which go over very well. There are 40 weekly recipes to choose from, and you can choose from over 100 items to round out the order, from snacks and easy lunches to desserts and pantry necessities. Everything arrives in one box on a delivery day of your choice. So, a great cooking experience, even for someone like me who's not that great at cooking. It's at least 25% cheaper than takeout. Go to HelloFresh.com/NEM16 and use the code NEM16 for, get this, 16 free meals plus free shipping. That is crazy. Now, I have previously on this podcast talked about Green Chef. Well, HelloFresh owns Green Chef. I have enjoyed both experiences. And even if you've used Green Chef before, you still get this new deal on HelloFresh specifically. Again, that's HelloFresh.com/NEM16. Use that code NEM16 for 16 free meals plus free shipping. HelloFresh, America's number one meal kit. I also want to tell you about The Psychology Podcast with Scott Barry Kaufman, who's a cognitive scientist who writes and researches on intelligence, creativity, and human potential. Psychology Podcast will give you a greater understanding of yourself, others, and the world we live in. In each episode, Scott explores the depths of human potential by talking to inspiring scientists, thinkers, and other self-actualized individuals. For example, Scott has interviewed renowned psychotherapist and author Esther Perel about love and relationships. He's also interviewed biologist David Sinclair about aging and longevity and Amanda Knox about trauma. Listen to the Psychology Podcast now, wherever you get your podcasts. All right, well, let's move back to what I think will be a less complicated song. I chose Little Big Songs. So I saw 2008. You have two albums there.
Yeah, I wanted to do one solo and one electric band version, one by myself.
Well, in the solo album, Little Big Songs, this might be my favorite album of them. They're all often kind of short, very quirky, very, you know, oh, here's like, this is almost a Neil Young song. Here's, you know, a straight piano ballad. So it's hard to, they didn't like the first one have, I feel like, you know, a kitchen sink approach of, they're very like, let's pick a theme. But this was one of the fatter ones, Buffalo Man, the second track off it. Can you say a few words about it before we hear it?
Again, influenced by film, the arrangement of it. There's a movie called To Have and Have Not with Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall. And in the movie, there's a house band in the bar that they hang out in. He stays in a room above this club. And Hoagie Carmichael is the band leader. And he has this band with like a Tibetan guy in it. And they're actual guys that play really weird instruments. And I always thought, man, I love that band. That particular arrangement has piano and trombones and tuba and bass and gongs and all kinds of stuff in it. That's, in fact, the only ensemble performance on that record. The song itself, man, I couldn't tell you what the hell I was writing about. I mean, I don't know what it was. Except
it's images. It's not a plot this time. It's images.
Yeah, it was just basically looking at people that with on the streets of Chicago that have carts loaded down with things and being on the train with, you know, people that and they all just they look more like if you're driving up to them, you see them as almost like buffaloes. They kind of look like buffalo men.
Okay, I was reading cowboy stuff into this just because of the tone, but actually looking like a buffalo.
That TV show Deadwood was out and my wife and I were absolutely hooked on it. So that was probably influencing me at the time because I had a friend that would make me DVDs because I didn't have HBO. And Penny and I would watch it every week. And we were just extremely influenced by the language in that and the people in that, too.
Once again, a cellular.
So nice piano-led tune. I want to have at least one piano-led tune in here. Is this something you've just done more and more of in recent years, or were you also a piano player as well as guitar sort of from the start?
That was my first instrument. Again, pretty much unschooled. My father was an unschooled piano player. It is told to me that around the age of 4, a Bach piece played on the radio. I walked over to the piano, literally spent my entire childhood sitting on my dad's lap with my hands on his while he played. You know, that was like the same way a kid would stand on the toes of their dad and he would walk them around when you were little. I did that with my hands on a piano, and I just started to play the Bach piece. It just all made sense to me all at once. And of course, my folks freaked out about it and tried to put me in piano lessons, but I already had a sophisticated enough ear that I could learn things faster with my ear than looking at a bunch of dots on a page, you know? So it kind of went away for a while, but I still think in pianos. So I play them. I play them poorly, the same as the way I play guitar, which is sloppy. I'm a slob when it comes to my virtuosity, so I'll never be that. But sloppy guitar player, I'm your man.
Piano just inevitably leads one to richer chord progressions, I think. I mean, guitar obviously has, let me leave some open strings while I put my fingers up and down. You know, there are some very rich things easily come out of guitar, and then you can do alternate tunings and get more fun out of it. But it's just such an open palette on piano.
It's got every instrument in it. It's great for arranging, obviously, because, you know, there they are. There's all your instruments. But for the most part, every guitar player I know plays a little bit of piano. And every piano player I know plays a little bit of guitar. But even when I play guitar, I'm thinking piano. It's just the way it is because it's my first instrument. Piano players tell me that I play guitar like a piano more than I play it like a guitar. But I half the time don't know the chords I'm playing. I'm a singer first and foremost, and I hum ideas, and then I hum another idea afterwards, which is, I think, why my arrangements can be interesting more so, because I'm not a schooled piano player. I'm not playing a sharp 9 and knowing what it is. You know, it's just I hear another note.
You're working with horn players then. It seems like you've been doing the arrangements right from the start. I know the next song we're going to talk about, you co-wrote with Roger Rupert, your trumpet player at the time.
Yeah. He's my friend since 2.5 years of age. So yeah, that was why.
Is it that you more and more took over the arrangement duties, or you were doing that right from the start?
Right from the start. Once you do it, it becomes something you really love to do. And truly, everything we talk about today and every person you'll ever talk about music with, the thing that really, you know, sets things apart is a lyric when they discover something that people have said in their heads but never put to words. Or it's the thing that makes things sound different is the arrangement every time. It's the last bastion of being able to make something sound unique is to arrange it in a way that you haven't heard it before.
I mean, I guess horns in particular, this is only because I've only done like a couple horn arrangements, and I like wrote them on kazoos and recorded them with kazoos and then brought them in. And of course, the horn players are going to be like, well, that's not the proper range for a trombone. Let's move this around, or let's get a different instrument in here or something. You got some fat. I noticed with the first song, I mean, it was a very wide horn arrangement with a little tiny, what is it, a piccolo trumpet? It's something that was very high on top.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The piccolo is Roger, who is still my trumpet player. He's got to have that piccolo because there are notes I write that are way up in and out of that range, you know. But
well, and you said tuba, that, you know, we're not going to rely on regular three-piece horn set. We're going to...
Yeah, it's the low end I worry more about, because you can get really high notes on a baritone sax and they sound crazy. It's when you go downstairs that you got to watch it. You know, there's certain notes I've written. The reason Andy Baker, for example, who's a great arranger and my trombone players in the band, as I was doing, I'm in another group called the Chi-Town Social Club with Daryl Jones and Vince Wilburn. And I wrote without him. It's the first time we'd worked together. And without him telling me that the baritone sax wouldn't reach this note, he just covered it on the trombone. He just went, that note, by the way, you can't get. You know, so he's the guy that does my sheet music for me. And he'll call me up and say, yeah, that note you wrote. And I'll go, yeah. He'll go, can't be done. You need people around you who like what you do, but aren't going to put you down for it. I'm sure when you arranged, you got into situations where people tried to intimidate you out of your arrangement, you know, when you were younger.
Maybe. One of the songs they said, well, leave it as kazoos, actually. that was as far as I went with that particular project. With it, they did a couple of songs, and the other one, they're like, no, actually, the kazoo sound fine. So I have a song with kazoo horn section that I did not intend. But
well, I know just enough about written music to know when someone's fucking with me. If I get some string players from the CSO that start, I can come right back. I know what they're saying. I know how to look at music. I know what it means. So I do just enough to, if I have someone that's going to try to mess with me, they can't.
In this song specifically, I mean, the horns are just like, it could have been a keyboard. They're just thickening. They're not like the first song where it was just horn blasts and the things that horns do specifically. This is just adding nice Spanish cowboy atmosphere to this series of images, as we were saying. And what, you got mandolin in there, you got, you know, having some slide guitar
in there, some tuba, some bass, a gong.
The weirdo percussion here that I would think at least for the last verse, put some steady percussion. But no, the percussion is just for the transitions, if I remember correctly, that it's just big roll two and then they're gone. And then it's just back to what it was.
It was very orchestrated. And I can honestly say it's probably from To Have and Have Not. The melody itself sounds very Japanese to me at the same time. But then again, my favorite director in the world is Akira Kurosawa. So, I mean, this all comes into that situation. He certainly was making Westerns when he made The Seven Samurai. You know, I mean, it kind of bookend each other. And I love sort of importing things the same way that a director like Sergio Leone or Kurosawa would. You know, themes that are not natural to their own upbringing. And I love doing that with my music as well. Yeah, I put an amen at the end of it.
That was it. Okay.
I don't know why, but it just, you know, I certainly wasn't thinking that way, but I did. I put an amen at the end of it. I went to the church, which is kind of crazy.
I wasn't sure if it fully actually did the major chord, you know, that we're, the whole thing has been minor and now we're going to make it like it doesn't quite get there, but I hear.
Step down to an amen. I don't know why.
Amen.
When I hear it now, I think of the movie Night of the Hunter too, which is like one of my favorite things I've ever seen. And the music in it, especially, that's kind of this crazy classical version of folk music. I guess that's kind of what I was doing. But again, it's just combining instruments. Aaron Copland said about looking at the score to The Rite of Spring for the first time. He says, even the notes on the page look at each other and say, what the hell are you doing here? It's that combination of things that makes it sort of compelling, you know, when you put instruments that generally, we've certainly been pushed that way, you know, even in bands we don't like. Hearing the accordion again in John Mellencamp stuff, you would never think an accordion would be a rock instrument 3 years before that. And all of a sudden, he's got it on every song. And all of a sudden, it's a rock instrument. But he's really just playing what we know, what you and I would know when we go hear the Chieftains or some Irish band doing a reel or something. All of a sudden, it's in that, and that influence comes back to the whole Harry Smith folk thing. I'm sure that's what Mellencamp was thinking, hearing those really early tunes when Lead Belly would suddenly do an accordion tune and stuff like that, because he's very American. Mm-hmm. But again, hearing it for the first time was like kind of shocking to hear an accordion again in rock music.
As far as the lyrics here, I mean, you said describing it as a series of images inspired by these people watching and, you know, combining the Western thing with the, I was just in New York City and there was a lot of times where people would be pushing big things down the street and I didn't know if they were homeless or just because transportation is weird in New York City and there are people that push big carts of stuff regularly. I've thought about like, what would it to be a musician in New York City and have to like get your amp onto, I don't know, rent a car every time or something.
It's all about that. All the rehearsal spaces have amps and drums there. And I think the big clue is Questlove, when Ludwig asked him to make a kit for him, he made a kit that would fit in the trunk of a taxi. He's got a commuter version of a drum set.
In any case, you've got these observations, but then it seems like with this last verse, you feel like it has to do something. Even if I'm not describing the person getting shot or something, it's tourniquet roll, gonna cut them down, running, you know, something like they're liable to end up in 6 feet under or something, like some sort of Western end. Do you know what you were doing with the last verse here? I wasn't even sure. Again, with lost in a winter of a world so wide, I wasn't sure what you were saying throughout that.
The winter of our discontent. You know, I've probably read 2 books. It's definitely about someone who doesn't have a roof over his head in life. Just like in life, for all of us, all you got to do is walk down the wrong street one day and everything changes. You can step off the curb and that's the end of you. I mean, we're all going to wind up in the same place, or, you know, unless it's apartment buildings. And I think that that's just when you live that way, you know that there's going to be that one moment that's going to change your life forever, for the worst, I guess is the best way to put it, or for the end of your life. And that's kind of what it was about. You know, I think about that shit a lot, I guess, because it keeps winding up in my songs.
Well, and I like this connection between living as a homeless person in a basically, right, if we had a real society, someone would move in and help you. It wouldn't be in that situation. So it is lawless in the same way that Deadwood, that these cowboy towns are, even though maybe 80% of the people are living in civilization, but no.
We kind of live in that same environment that, you know, that Deadwood's about in a strange way. We live in a lawless society because we don't follow the rules, especially now more than ever. I think we're just all lawbreakers. We're all crooks in our own way, the way we listen to music. And the world is crooked and it's designed by people that are making money off what we do. You know? So I don't think that much has changed about America. The facade of freedom, all freedoms eventually get corrupted. And they were corrupt in those days. They're still corrupt. I live in Chicago. I'm like, you know, an aficionado of corruption. Mm-hmm. And I loved it when it was something I could participate in earlier Chicago. When I'd get pulled in by a cop car and they'd have me to sit in the back and one cop would say to the other, geez, you know, I'm kind of hungry. And the other one would say, yeah, I'd love to eat pizza. And I would say, gee, officer, what's a pizza cost these days? And they'd say, oh, about $30. And I'd hand them $30 and I'd walk away. I love participating in Chicago corruption. It's just harder and harder to do it now. And for all the right reasons. But I miss it. I miss that relationship, if that makes sense.
Well, let's move back to a simpler time, the 80s. You had pointed me at River of Love. Perhaps the biggest single, at least I was in the Chicago area. I would have been 15 at this point. And WXRT, I know, was one of the radio stations that I listened to. If I hadn't gotten too snobby for radio yet, quite at that point. But yes, River of Love from More Than Truth, 1986. Yeah, give us your intro to that.
Well, it's an interesting album because basically the label, the reason the record sold so well was not because of that song, which is really kind of strange. Although in Chicago, that was the hit. More Than the Truth got picked up by BET, and BET sold that record for me, which is a lovely thing. But River of Love was big. It's the only guitar solo on the album, and it's Bonnie Raitt playing it. And she asked me, this was right before the year after that, she won that multiple Grammy album and all. But she asked me, oh, I'd love to sing on this. Can I sing in this too? And I said, no, I've got enough singers.
There is room for the singers jam for the last whole minute of the song. It seems like there's...
Yeah. So I was like, no, I really don't need an extra singer, Bonnie, but why don't you play the slide guitar on it? And she's the lead guitarist on that album, which is hilarious to me.
Full of holes from the cries of the souls being.
Right. So nice R&B bass line. It's all built on this.
The harmonies are very staple singers-y. There was a short story my cousin read me. My cousin was a writer, and he could read short stories so beautifully. So when we would hang out, we'd go home, and if he'd read something new, he would read me the short story. And the short story was called The Moon in Its Flight. Very romantic short story by a writer who has since passed named Gilbert Sorrentino. I don't know if you remember this writer at all. He was never a big famous influential. He didn't have that moment, you know, that somebody like even that disappears like a Kenneth Franzen had with The Confessions and all that. But I love the title. So Still of the Night, Moon in Its Flight. It's first line of the song. I stole that from him. Then, you know, it really is kind of like a staple singer idea of what a song is. It kind of moves like Sir Mac Rice would write, Respect Yourself or something like that. But that whole groove, that thing really smells like a staple singer tune to me in a way.
So, for instance, the plethora of vocal jamming at the end, how coordinated was that? Was it, you know, we were overdubbing each person one at a time because that's how you do on a big label thing?
That style of recording in the 80s, definitely that for sure. But it was definitely Mavis. Hey, man, on the moon. Yeah, it was written with Mavis Staples in mind. You know, those harmonies. And of course, the girls at the time that I have, who I still have, Sean Christopher was Chaka Khan's vocal. She was the head of her backup vocals. And Yvonne Gage was in there. And who else was in there? Shay Jones. Both Yvonne and Shay had just come out of singing with Ministry, believe it or not, even though they were total soul singers from the church. And so, yeah, it was real easy to explain to them, look, this is like a Mavis thing. And they went, you know, they knew exactly where to go. I didn't have to tell them.
And then with the horn arrangements for this one. So again, this is co-written with Roger. Does that mean that he kind of took the horn arrangements or you still were?
That means he knew how to write horn arrangements. And he was my best friend since 2.5 years of age. So we just became a partner of that. When I'd gone under my own name, I wanted horns because I thought in horns. And I just said, you want to do this with me? And that's how we started. Roger was by no means a jazz player at that time that much. He had played in more orchestration sort of stuff. But looking at a piece of sheet music to him was like looking at the newspaper. So it was a perfect moment at the time for us to come together and write tunes.
And so was he participating more in the arrangement or actually coming up with the tune from scratch? This was a two-person operation.
No, I come up with it from scratch and it's more with the arrangement and stuff like that. But sometimes the arrangement, he'd say, why don't you go here instead? So we'd steer the thing around once we got to the arrangement. The arrangement for me is always the thing that takes the song the next way into something.
Have you had experiences or failed attempts to fully collaborate with another songwriter?
Oh, yeah, yeah. You know, I've done arrangements on people's albums for years. I've done 40 film scores that require big arrangements off the time, even if they're sampled ones that I have to. When you do film scoring because of budgets, you do what I call counterfeiting a lot. And I'm a great counterfeiter of, you know, horn arrangements and string arrangements and stuff. So yeah, I've done some that work out. And then some people whom I admire completely are just people that were like oil and water. At this age, I learned that really quick. They learn it really quick. It's not insulting by any means. It just ain't going to happen.
It seems like there are things in here that maybe you wouldn't write today. Hey, man in the moon, here's a tune going to rock your soul. That does not seem like your current style.
Now you're just making me feel itchy. But yeah.
That's what I'm asking is what your relationship is to your, you said this is one you still play and it's so groovy. Like I listening to this one repeatedly, like I can totally see wanting to take this up as if you were playing a cover song because it's, you know, it's so long ago. It's almost a different person.
We do it second line New Orleans style at this point. And we do from that same album, a song called This Song, because I think that the themes behind it are still relevant. If I could say that anything took the longest for me to get good at, meaningful at, it's lyrics. I got better at it. And really, it was just like anything. I just started to read a lot more. And it's not music that brought me into better lyrics or, boy, I wish I could write like that guy. I just started reading better books, better poetry, better things like that. And looking at better scripts on films, you know, going to see plays, going to see paintings. My lyrics got better because I stayed away from music is the best way to put it. started to become more of an artist. So then these things come back to you, you know, and in terms of music, it's just my initial ideas of what I wanted to be as a musician seemed unrealistic when I got into the music business. And then at a certain point, you realize you were right. Just like any artist, you know, that when you were coloring outside of the lines and not looking at the lines, you were right. Music was wrong. The industry was wrong. You know, if that makes any sense. I thought the world was that. Listen, I finished my first album. I made two phone calls. I called Leonard Bernstein and I called the guy who did, oh my God, Gil Evans. I thought that's what getting a record contract was, that you called these guys and that now they wanted to work with you. You know, that's not the case. There's always 100 different ways I could have started that would have probably been a better idea. I probably should have called Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff and said, I want to make a big ass soul record. And at my age, you just want to leave something that makes sense to you, you know? And right now, what makes sense to me is big, beautiful records. And also because I miss big, beautiful records. Isaac Hayes is one of my heroes. I listen to Going in Circles once a week because it's the most gorgeous thing I've ever heard. And he totally rewrites the original song and it's fantastic. And I lament the fact that people don't make records like this that much anymore because they can't afford to unless they've had hits and stuff. But there were huge jazz records, you know, the Ellington stuff, all these records that people would do with large orchestrations and huge orchestrations, Donnie Hathaway's records and stuff, and Curtis Mayfield's records. I love those records. You can't make them in a home studio. First off, I love capturing performances. And second off, I love beautiful arranging.
Well, and that seems like you hit on a recipe for doing something that's actually affordable, that we're going to arrange the hell out of it, get amazing people so you don't have to rehearse. And then, yes, you've spent a lot of money on, but it's only for a few hours, you know, for per song, at least for the new albums. I mean, this old one, it's also a big, beautiful arrangement, like, I couldn't exactly figure out how many, is there also piano and a couple guitars, but, you know, or how many singers do you have going here? But I'm glad we could include this one because you're coloring inside the lines on this one. And I could imagine with as freaky as the organ playing on this is, you probably didn't have to orchestrate that or tell this guy, you know, it's just like, that's what a B3 player does.
That's my roommate at the time. That's Ivan Neville playing from Dumpster Funk and all that. That's him. He's all over that record. He didn't have a record contract yet. He was just getting out of Bonnie Raitt's band. And we got thrown together by my producer. Oh, this is Ivan. He's going to play on your record. And I had a keyboard player already. And I was like, all right, what's this about? We wrote a song called Losing You on that record. We wrote the first day we'd ever met. We just immediately hit it off. We had the same kind of listen. He listens when he plays. Great, I do. And that record is as much Ivan's as mine, as far as I'm concerned.
I saw you had some connection with Neville Brothers. I see that Ivan is Aaron Neville's son. So you had this some sort of plug in. At the point that this came out, it seems like that kind of blues, as you mentioned, Bonnie Raitt, but also like the Fabulous Thunderbirds. And like it was having some kind of a moment.
Yeah, it certainly was. Especially if you lived in Chicago and you listened to XRT radio at the time. Because for one thing, Bonnie was the poster child of that radio station to the point where, man, how many Bonnie Raitt tunes are they going to play today? She was sort of the poster child of FM radio when it was FM radio still. So yeah, people like that, Sugar Blues on that record. Maceo Parker's on that record because I'm a big James Brown guy. And he's the sax player on that record as well.
So I'm confused then, given how successful this seems to have been, why there is not a 1989 album or something? Why then you sort of took a break and had a completely different sound in the early 90s? And then I got your eventual album, Bloody Show, which has a screed in the beginning in the liner notes about how major labels are not daring enough. So you like went indie and went much more in sort of the Alejandro or the shed the horn section or.
Again, that's the 90s. But there's a certain point when you're working for, and because I'm so loyal, that you're writing constantly for your band, which at the time was 13 pieces as well. I mean, we had big backup horn, so it had to have backup, had to have horn, everything. And I just looked at what I was doing and realized I wasn't writing anymore. I was arranging more than I was writing to try to make everybody have something to do. not even for the song. And also people weren't showing it up as much for rehearsals because it was sort of the tail end of being the cash cow for a lot of people. And I just called a rehearsal one day, 2 days in advance, and everybody that showed up was in the next band. That's how I looked at it. So it's just like, okay, so now we're going to be this big. And then I just started writing different. At the time, it wasn't by any means a staple yet, but Americana was starting to rear its head with some of these, what they called alt country and everything like that.
Yep.
You know, that was a big discovery for me as a person from the North, because I thought every time I heard a country tune, somebody was hanging a black guy. You know what I mean? I was a real Northern guy, and I didn't like country music because I thought it was square and I thought it was racist because I believed what I read. At any rate, you start to realize these are some of the best songs you've ever heard. And as Charlie Parker said to his band, that was like, why do we always have to listen to country music stations when we're driving to a gig? He goes, because those guys know how to tell stories and you don't, which I think is great. So then I got back into that. And just, you know, when you find out that the most unpredictable singer you're ever going to hear is George Jones, kind of changes your life. You know, it was like a new discovery. And for me, making records and why they're always different is something has to affect me and feel exotic for me to get excited about music again. And that did.
I had to go and live in Austin for 6 years before I learned that same lesson that I was, we should mention to the audience, I never have somebody else on from Northbrook, that we are the same hometown, the same suburb of Chicago. But yes, but I went to college in Ann Arbor. So that wasn't any different in terms of the landscape. But yes, the time in Texas, and now it seems that gospel has definitely reached the Midwest. You know, there's so many alt country bands or traditional musics of various sorts playing folk music and reels and whatever.
I just did a record that was really kind of folk rock, you know, and I was the lead guitar player, which I hadn't been in a while. And I also was the arranger. And the reason I did arrangements for this guy was he didn't realize how many people were making cowboy chord songs out there, what I call open chords. And I was just like, dude, something better happen here that makes this record different than that, because there's just a real onslaught of that singer-songwriter stuff out there. So you got to make it different. I just make things a little more different because, like I said, my A chord may be different than yours, but it's still an A chord.
Well, let's leave folks with, I always like to put a little catchy one at the end that we just introduced, Superhuman Love. I just listened to this as a single from 2010, was blown away. I saw it was on the For the Baby Doll 2013 album. Sort of a T-Rex vibe to this. Can you say a little about this before we say goodbye?
Yeah, I guess T-Rex is a good point to that, because T-Rex always had the greatest backbeat in the world on his tunes. It's really what we call a lumpty lump, that rhythm in Chicago. And I'll explain what that is by saying that as a kid, I used to take the train from Northbrook downtown to the L to play at Silvio's and Teresa's, which were these blues clubs. And I would bring my guitar and wait to go up on jam nights. And Mighty Joe Young was doing a jam night at Teresa's. And so finally, after 3 nights of buying guys drinks with my little fake IDs, he let me on stage at the end of the night. And I played a little guitar riff, like a lead riff. He turned to me and he said, "No, no, no, little brother, only lumpty lump." And I went, "Okay." And the bass player looked at me and he went, "Lumpty, lumpty, 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 lumpty." So that's what a lumpty lump is. And I wanted to, on this album, to do a pop tune that was a lumpty lump. But it's a Brit thing. It's very Mark Boland. It's very T-Rex because of that. But Mark always had the best beats. And I'm friends with Tony Visconti, and I always talk to him about that. That and the fact that he's the best arranger of bowed low basses. I love it. Like, I was in my guitar. His shit always goes lower than anybody's. And he arranges. So Tony loves that I recognize that in him. And the fact that the backbeat on those records is brilliant.
Well, thanks so much for doing this. We should mention just a couple of the other things that you've done. I mean, you mentioned all the soundtrack stuff. I wasn't aware of that. Is there a place we can hear that somewhere?
Well, you've got to kind of be in Chicago because I've done a lot of stuff with PBS. You know, I'm also in a band called the Fauntleroys with Alejandro and Ivan Julian.
Yes.
And
so you are the third. That is why I heard of you, is because Ivan recommended you, and I heard that EP from when I had Alejandro on here several years ago. So that's great. And I saw you started with Cheap Trick, you know, this interview about how much you loved
So I still love playing that. So we have a whole record out of Candy Gold. And just, we've been waiting for one person to springboard it. We've had it for like 4 years. It's a beautiful album. Rick Rizzo and I wrote all the songs from 11th Dream Day. He's a great songwriter. And for some reason, I can sit in a room with Rick and in 1 hour write a song. It's the only person on earth I can do that.
Well, there you go. That's what I was asking, whether you actually, you know, had been not just arranging with somebody else, but like actually had in the room chemistry to, the, you know, to create something that was fundamentally
different. Me and Alejandro and me and Ivan can whip off a song really quick. Me and Rick Rizzo, it's almost, we both leave so surprised. Every time we start together, we finish. And it's always due to the fact that he has to go pick up his kids or I have to go do something. In that period of time, we will have a song done completely. And I don't know what it is about, you know, certain people that I can write, that we can write fast and loose.
All right. Well, I will try to link to some of these other projects from the blog post associated with this at nakedlyexaminedmusic.com. Here's Superhuman Love. Thank you, Nick. I hope a lot more people hear about you in today's economy.
This is the most thorough interview I've ever done in my life. And that's something.
Why bother doing it otherwise? I guess.
The rest of your ilk needs to hear that. I'm telling you, it's amazing. It's been a lot of fun.
Make my way. Gone are the ways.
Thanks so much to Nick. That was a very fun one, both in talking to him and the prep. Nick does not seem to have a single website right now, but you can find him on Facebook. You can look him up on SoundCloud, and he has a YouTube channel. I also want to point out the Facebook page for Chi-Town Social Club. We didn't talk about that band. I had not actually listened to that band. It features Daryl Jones, current bassist for the Rolling Stones, and Daryl and the drummer Vince Wilburn Jr. both played with Miles Davis in the 80s. Vince Wilburn Jr. is actually Miles Davis's nephew, and the lead singer to that is a woman named Sean Christopher, who was the singer on several chart-topping dance singles in the late 80s, early 90s. I should also point out that even just looking on Spotify, there are something like 5 different entries for Nicholas Tremulous. And some of his old albums are only available on YouTube right now. And his 90s stuff, I was only able to get just ordering off of eBay. So hopefully he will get his discography in order at some point. But you can easily find the last 5 albums or so, and they're very good. So hope you check them out. If I did not already say this, this completes my coverage of the folks in the supergroup The Fauntleroys, which is Alejandro Escovedo, Ivan Julian that I had recently, and now Nicholas. So that's actually how I found out about him. So that's a fun little EP that you'll now know all of the voices from if you want to track that down on one of the streaming services. As you have likely noticed, the release for this podcast has become a little less reliably every 2 weeks than it has been previously, but we are getting more host-read ads that are supposed to come out on particular days. So as long as that happens, then I will go back to my regular schedule. I have, since we last talked, recorded 2 more very interesting interviews. The first with Michael Gira from Swans, which was an interview I was very excited to get because when I recorded with him in 2019, that is one of the only interviews that just got eaten by my computer. So I finally got to make that right. And then I just yesterday talked to Bonjo Noah of African Head Charge. I don't know if you've heard of this band. Bonjo is a world-renowned percussionist from Ghana. He played in reggae bands in the 70s, based in Britain, who works with a producer to create psychedelic Africana, starting in the early 80s up to now. It's very interesting stuff, very groovy. You can make sure that you get those interviews promptly by making sure you're subscribed directly to the Nakedly Examined Music podcast. The links to do that are through nakedlyexaminedmusic.com or just look us up on the streaming service of your choice. Although if you listen on Spotify or YouTube, it's just part of the Partially Examined Life feed, our parent network. Although I gotta say, if you're listening on YouTube, don't do that. It's an objectively inferior experience. They insert all sorts of ads that I don't benefit from, just for the cost of my having the files up there. But of course, the thing I would prefer is for you to go to patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic. I want to say thanks to Georgie, a new supporter since last time I asked for supporters, plus Ethan, Christopher, Bernard, Mark, and David, my other current paid supporters there, as well as all the folks that have supported me in the past, and folks that support the Partially Examined Life, which indirectly funds this. But more than that, I hope you will support the artists that I feature on here. Go out to their shows. Go buy their records. I strongly recommend getting yourself set up on Bandcamp so you're listening to those streams on your phone rather than Spotify or Apple that doesn't pay that much to the artists. And if you find yourself listening to an album more than once, throw them a few bucks. They'll really appreciate it. And you will have contributed to art continuing to happen in the world. I hope you're all doing well. Until next time, keep on musicking. This is Mark Lissemeyer signing off.